right, class, let's take a quick jaunt through early Western Europe, and this will take us pretty much from the ancient era that we just covered in our last module up until sort of the early history of the United States as we understand it today. So we're going to take another look through this scope of sort of the cultural history of recreation. That is, how do we get to where we are? Why do we think of leisure and recreation the ways that we do relative to what's happened before? So a lot of what we are and do and know and see today has recognizable roots in some earlier cultures. So that's why we're going after what we are today. And with that, let's get into early Western Europe. So up until about 1500, life is difficult in Western Europe. So we've talked a little bit about what things were like for the Greeks and Romans and so forth. As it turns out, if you were living in Western Europe, sort of from the year 1000 AD or CE, depending on your date system, up till about 1500, you had some pretty difficult circumstances to live through in terms of sickness, life expectancy, stuff like that. So it's not necessarily a very cheerful story, but it is an important one. Okay, so let's fast forward to this guy, King Alfred. He set forward an idea called the 3/8 division of time or labor. And the idea here is that based on what was sort of nominally Christian ideal at the time, this guy had the idea that if you were a freeborn, that is, if you weren't sort of a lowly peasant or serf, you should spend 3/8 of your time in total on leisure and all of the things that could be sort of filed under that, including outdoor recreation. So a lot of the things that we recognize to be sort of aristocratic traditions, like fox hunts, tournaments and stuff like that, sort of started to show up under this idea from monarchs like King Alfred that suggested that, okay, a noble's time was best spent not necessarily laboring throughout. There are a lot of social connections, there's a lot of exercise, there are a lot of sort of higher ideals to be realized if you could afford to do so. And of course, 90% plus of everybody is not in this camp. So sounds like a great idea on paper, but it didn't necessarily percolate down to everybody for a very long time. Okay, and the primary division we're talking about here is the serf versus the landed class, which means that if you were a serf, you were functionally a tenant farm family, working on sort of your lord's and lady's manor. So you do a lot of the farming by hand. They had pre-industrial tools, and a lot of it was literal horsepower type things. So life was difficult, sort of hard scrabble. The famous quote from Hobbes, the philosopher and historian, was, "Life is nasty, mean, brutish, and short." Doesn't sound so good. And unfortunately, one side effect of that was that 90% of your earnings had to go towards food, because that's just what you made, and much of the rest ended up going towards basic durable goods like clothing, tools, repair, stuff like that. But it also, in some fraction, went to not quite tax, but sort of tribute to the landowner or the landed class, the gentry that you were sort of ostensibly farming for. Okay. Also at this time, we should note that across Western Europe, we have a count of approximately 40,000 monasteries. Okay, now this is prior to the Protestant Reformation, so these are pretty much all Catholic monasteries, and these sort of sucked away from the serf and the landed class, primarily the landed class, a lot of folks that we'd otherwise see spending a lot of their time on things like leisure and recreation. Monastics, monks, taking things like vows of silence and poverty and chastity and all of that. So that had a fairly observable effect on the structure of society, and to a lesser extent, the same way that World Wars I and II had a very measurable or observable effect on societies by removing, basically, the young, healthy men of an entire generation for each one of those world wars. A similar but smaller effect was seen with these monasteries. So these guys are showing up at these places and committing to a life of poverty and chastity and so forth. And that kind of changed the direction of who was available, if nothing else, for things like leisure. Okay? But leisure for, in particular, sort of the non-rich folks up until about 1500s in Western Europe looked a lot like this. So we have the expansion of Muslim culture as far west as southern Spain. We call that culture the Moors. And with With the Moors, with Arab culture comes things like board games and chess. So chess, as a proxy for war, gets distilled down in sort of a harmless game format, and it was actually very, very popular. Let's see. The other things that we see for sort of community level and surf level recreation and leisure were things like informal music making. So it's very cheap and easy to make a reed flute, like a little pan flute kind of thing. So there's social history records of things like that. And there was also a big emphasis on community-level leisure and play, much more than we experience today in the United States, because, unfortunately, the child mortality rate was extremely high, and the parent mortality rate was extremely high, as human beings, unfortunately, without access to very high-quality medical care, the riskiness of pregnancy for Homo sapiens sapiens is really pretty high. The infant cranium to birth canal size ratio is not favorable for human beings in the way that it is for many other mammals. So it's actually pretty dangerous in this time, that is Europe up to the 1500s, to have children. Mom could die. The baby could certainly die. If the baby survives birth, there's a really pretty good chance, between 30 and 50%, that it's not going to make it to age 3 or 4, right? So very, very difficult time to be a part of a family. So the very sort of natural outflow of that was that there were a lot of orphans. And so a lot of children in this time and in this place were raised by an aunt and uncle in the next village over, or a more distant relative, maybe a little bit further away. A lot of orphanages full of kiddos, right? And people attempting to have big families, sort of playing the odds, knowing that a lot of their kids just flat out aren't going to survive. Kind of a grim picture. But anyway, that does mean that there were, in many cases, large families, lots of little kids running around having fun. And so it took a very sort of community approach to raising those kids. And as one collateral of that, lots and lots of play, lots of games, lots of, you know, running around the village, hitting each other with sticks kind of stuff. Okay? There were also very sharp differences in how males versus females were allowed to recreate or take leisure during this period, right? So males are allowed to go through or go to places like bar rooms. They're allowed to do things like gambling and bull baiting, which is sort of the medieval version of cow tipping, right? So get into the field with the bull and see if you can piss it off and then get out safely. That pretty well turns out exactly the way you would imagine. Females, not so much, right? So in conservative cultures, even today, we see this, where in many cases, women had less volition outside of the home, certainly outside of the community context, to do things that we'd recognize as leisure or fun. They were much more sort of required to be sort of tied to the kids and family much more of the time. So wasn't exactly a fair distribution of time or leisure, but that is the way it was at that time. Okay? So, extending this idea that the men were much more socially allowed or permitted to go to places like taverns, bar rooms, stuff like that, let's talk about the apprentice-journeyman-master dynamic up through this time. So, up to this point, a lot of people not really going to college, right? Oxford is only a couple of hundred years old at this point, as one of the first universities, and that meant that education took much more of a trades-focused approach, right? So you start out as a kid, anywhere from 8, 9, 10 years old, working as an apprentice for some kind of a journeyman or a master in your trade. So a cooper makes barrels, right? A cobbler makes shoes. A tanner makes leather products. Blacksmith does smithy work and ferrying. Okay, and so forth, right? So you sort of learn the ropes, you do a bunch of the grunt work as an apprentice, and then as a journeyman, you're actually moving up to the stage of acquiring the skills that the master blacksmith can impart to you, training you to replace him or replace that shop or expand to the next village over, that sort of thing. Okay? Now, this means that you have a lot of young men working very hard, typically separated from their families for very long periods of time. And so we get this sort of interesting social dynamic showing up in terms of leisure, right? So in the contracts that journeymen were required to agree to, we have language like this. Taverns and alehouses he shall not haunt. Dice, cards, or any other unlawful game he shall not use. Fornication with any woman he shall not commit. Matrimony with any woman he shall not contract. Right? Not allowed to date, not allowed to get married, not allowed to smoke, drink, spit, chase the women who do. Right? He shall not absent himself by day or by night without his master's leave, but be a true and faithful servant. So, this is a little bit like the concept of slavery that we talked about in Greek and Roman times, where it's not quite slavery as we think of it today. It's much more of a, maybe not much more, it's more of a professional type relationship, one that can end at the discretion of either party, to some extent. Okay? So, implied in these rules, or these sort of contractual requirements for journeymen, is the suggestion that, okay, well, if you're not allowed to go to taverns and alehouses as a journeyman and get together with other journeymans, well, it's at least suggesting that guys were doing this stuff, right? I mean, you don't make a rule against something that's not going to happen. So, we have sort of a Jets versus Sharks, if you're in a musicals thing going on, with some of these different journeyman groups, where we'd have these inter-trade brawls, right? Like, everybody, the equivalent here in Carbondale would be like, you know, the English majors and the forestry majors show up at Pinch Penny Pub on Friday night and just fight, right? And it's like an every Friday kind of thing. So these intertrade brawls sort of became sort of a long-running joke and later actually became a bit of a social organizing mechanism, right? So you meet these people, you punch them out a little bit, blow off some steam at the end of the week kind of thing, but you actually make some good connections as well. And so this sort of brawl, sort of frat house style culture ends up growing into, later on, secret societies, giving way to festivals and rites and secret handshakes and high fives and that sort of thing. Okay? So, if you were not just sort of a scrabbling in the dirt serf, and you weren't necessarily landed gentry, somewhere in the middle we have sort of what will later become the emerging middle class, right? So, these journeymen, these craftsmen, these artisans of all varying kinds start to form things like professional societies, okay? So drinking was deeply enmeshed in this emerging sort of middle-class recreation dynamic, right? So Ben Franklin, a little bit later, this is a couple hundred years later in the United States. We have a quote from Ben Franklin, drank every day a pint before breakfast, a pint at breakfast with his bread and cheese, because you don't want to start too soon, that's what the alcoholics do, a pint between breakfast and dinner, a pint at dinner, a pint in the afternoon about 6 o'clock, and another when he had had done his day's work. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 by lunchtime, 5, 6 pints. That's 3 quarts. That's 3/4 of a gallon of beer a day, which sounds like a lot. But you think that it wasn't until several hundred years later when we figured out things like germs in our water kill us from things like explosive diarrhea. And so alcohol, specifically in the form of beer, was one gift from all of those 40,000 monasteries, okay, to help make basic drinking water potable. We didn't necessarily understand what killed us, right? So at this time, you know, people are using leeches and bloodletting and talking about the four humors and so forth, trying to get a sense of human health. In many ways, they're sort of way off in left field, but alcoholic drinks, wine in earlier cultures like the Greek and Romans, provided one form of potable water with some serious, of course, side effects. But it was at least seen as, in terms of basic public health, actually a step forward. We also have these things called Saturnalia, which in Western Europe were sort of the Catholic Church's attempt to take a whole bunch of different pagan holidays, things like we recognize Christmas these days, that was actually based on a pagan holiday, in terms of celebrating it on December 25th and using things like Christmas trees and evergreens and all of that. The original sort of practice and rituals that we associate with Christmas, like the Yule log, for example, were taken from pagan traditions to help sort of ease pagans' transition into being Catholics as that spread across Europe and across the world at that time. So Saturnalia is one of those. And Saturnalia was a little bit like our modern-day Mardi Gras, especially sort of the Brazilian flavor of Mardi Gras, where it was seen as a big excuse, even among sort of these ostensibly Catholic villages, to just party like a rock star, just get loose, get completely stupid, you know, running around, hooking up with people, waking up 3 days later, two villages over, sore and naked. I mean, just all kinds of craziness going on, recorded in connection with Saturnalia. Okay? And then the idea is, that's leisure. That's an excuse to party hard, relax, play around for a couple of days. And then we can go to church, confess our sins, be absolved of all that stuff, cleaned up, good to go. Okay? So Saturnalia, and actually the Christian church's appropriation of pagan ritual, led to very widespread and sort of socially acceptable, somewhat socially acceptable, kinds of leisure. Okay? Onward. Let's swing back to those elites. So, when I say elite, we're talking about the clergy, the scholars, the royalty, warriors, so knights and squires. Collectively, these are the landed elite. Okay, so wealth is tied to land ownership. How many acres at that time, not hectares, did you control, and how much sort of revenue did that provide for you as basically passive income, right? So these guys were funded on the backs of serfs. Lots of trade monopolies with those various trade guilds, like the blacksmiths and so forth. They were able to control a lot of the flow of wealth back and forth, and in so doing, free themselves up for a whole lot of leisure, which looks like the list on the right side of the slider. So, fox and hart, H-A-R-T, is deer hunting. So, longbow hunting, tournaments with the longbow, which was a military development, showed up prominently in battles between the English and French in particular, and basically the longbow had a whole lot more punching power and range versus the short bows that archers had been using previously. And you can kind of translate that to sort of recreational shooting as well, or archery. Falconry, developed for hunting and also taken out of the Mediterranean, ended up being sort of a huge, sort of highly skills-based and training-based form of outdoor recreation. Combat training ends up sort of taking a page out of the Greek and Roman playbook and turning straight-up military drills into basically combat tournaments. So if you ever saw that awful Heath Ledger A Knight's Tale movie, we all regret that. It's that kind of stuff, right? So knights in shining armor is pretty much where we get the expression. These guys are sort of the sports stars of their day, right? So there's a heavy emphasis on individualism, so kind of a celebrity effect to specific knights who are good at a particular part of the tournament, like the joust or the lists or the sword fighting on foot, sword fighting on horseback, archery, and so forth, right? So you get sort of the rock stars of each one of those fields. And it was a very, very individualistic thing. There was no sort of real emphasis on teams. So this was typically done within the purview or confines of regions within a country or across the entire country, if it had a stable monarchy in place at the time. Much less commonly across borders, right? So the focus here is on the individual. All right. We also, around this time, running up to about 1500, get things like the legend or the tales of King Arthur and Robin Hood. And these guys help return a sense of the everyman to things like storytelling and sort of the social values espoused about literature and about recreation. So with Robin Hood, there's a lot of recounting, lots of different versions of the Robin Hood myths and legends, but in many of them there's very clearly an element of not just taking money from the rich, but also taking a lot of, or appropriating a lot of these sort of activities that are reserved for the rich. So you cannot go hunting in the king's reserve, and if you do, you'll be put to death, or they'll chop your hands off and throw you in the jail, something like that. Well, Robin Hood stands in direct contrast to that, right? So he's stealing from the rich and giving to the poor and, you know, trying to fight off Prince John and the Sheriff of Nottingham and stuff like that. So there's a lot of leisure sort of built into the ideals behind those stories, okay? There's also the emergence of what's later called chivalry, from the French word for horse, cheval. And chevalier is a horseman. And this really showed up in the 1100s, the 12th century, under Eleanor of Aquitaine. And basically the idea here is we're taking those combat tournaments, which are sort of like sports tournaments these days, but it's all sort of very individual focused, and gilding it, giving it a sense of, okay, we're returning this to the nobility, and we're going to ascribe very sort of noble and what we understand today as chivalrous values to it. So it's not just that, you know, Sir Gawain over here is really good at bashing in people's brains with his sword while he's on horseback, or really good at jousting. He's doing it for the approval and on behalf of the honor of whatever lady has tied her little scarf to the end of his lance. That's a metaphor, okay? So chivalry gets tied to, or is a tie between, combat tournaments, which are used later for leisure, and sort of the nobility looking for something to watch, right? The first big sports fans show up in this time, okay? Under the banner of chivalry. And let's make it a nice big tournament and turn it into a very honorable thing instead of a very violent thing and so forth, okay? So if you've ever gone to a Renaissance festival, and hopefully you had a little bit of fun, this is completely where that came from. This has an actual basis in reality. It's pretty cheesy today for the safety of the performers and so forth, but at that time, it was kind of a big deal. Okay, let's now cross from pre-1500 to 1500 and forward. So in the 1500s, some major things happen and completely throw Western Europe into utter turmoil. So up until this point, the Catholic Church has been a major stabilizing and unifying force, right? The nations of Western Europe that we recognize today were nominally Christian nations, and they all sort of paid some degree of tribute or tithe to the Catholic Church. And so for resolving things like border conflicts and stuff like that, Catholic Church is a big deal, big kind of peacekeeper, sort of the UN of its era. But in the 1500s, that all sort of comes tumbling down. This guy, Martin Luther, 1517, writes 95 theses. Now, the guy is a Catholic and sort of a professional Catholic. But he sees a lot of problems that have grown up over the years inside the Catholic Church. And he really has a pretty big beef with what's going on. So, there are sort of different stories involved. At one point, he was riding his horse during a storm. It was a really bad storm, lightning all around, and he gets kicked off the horse, and he's pretty sure he's going to die, and he says, God, if you bring me through this, I swear to you I will give my life to, you know, serving you and as best I understand, and so forth. And so he makes it through the night, and a little bit later, pens what his 95 theses. And so these are 95 problems. Things that he's positing are wrong with the Catholic Church, sort of structurally wrong. So stuff like indulgences, being able to pay off your sins instead of having to confess them and do penance and sort of be contrite. You can just sort of pay money to the church and all of a sudden you're forgiven, and so forth. This was one of them. So he writes those 95 things, nails them to the front door of, I believe, a church, and sets off quite the storm afterwards. And so the Catholic Church ends up actually splitting in Europe between the Lutherans, people following Martin Luther and saying, we have got to reform this church, strip away a bunch of these old sort of traditions and kick out all the corrupt priests and so forth, versus sort of the conventional Catholics that stay aligned to Rome. So this sort of splits Europe in half. And a lot of the Germanic states, a lot of the Germanic princes ended up siding with Martin Luther so that they could sort of separate themselves politically from the church, not have to send money to it and stuff like that. So he finds refuge with some of these friendly Germans and basically splits Europe in half. Also at this time, that apprentice journeyman master program or system is now fully sort of leading to the development or the emergence of a recognizable middle class. It's not just serfs, it's not just the elite looking at each other from sort of across the railroad tracks of their time, I guess the oxcart road. Now there's somebody in between. All the merchants and so forth, all the skilled trades can make a pretty decent living. They'll never retire super rich, except for a few notable families like the Medicis, but for the most part, they're doing okay. Like, they have decent houses, and they don't have to eat crap, and so forth. So, we also see a further, further split from Catholicism with schools of thought like Puritanism. So, these are the same Puritans, or sort of an early version of the Puritans, that are going to show up in the early American colonies for looking for religious freedom, okay? Now, these guys take sort of a hard line swing away from the Catholic practice at that time of things like Saturnalia. Party hard and then just confess or buy off your sins later, you're good to go. The Puritans say, you know what? God put us on earth to do something. And that means work, not play. So work is a kind of worship. It's a very holy thing, right? So God gave you two hands and a strong back and so forth. You better freaking be using it. It's basically the idea. Okay? So they take time, specifically work time, and actually structure it and use that as a ruler for how good you are. Or, here's the key point, how much better you did this year than last year in terms of the percentage of your time where you were working effectively instead of lounging around, being lazy, and so forth. Okay, so one place we see some of these ideals showing up are in places like Geneva, which was basically a theocracy. It was a city led and run by guys like John Calvin in the mid-1500s that tried to take the New Testament Bible, strip out a whole bunch of the sort of Catholic tradition layered on top of it, and then build a functional working city out of that. So the Calvinists took a pretty hard line. The Puritans were an example of an extremely hard line separation from the Catholic Church and their ideas of leisure and how to spend time. Okay? So, some more of the specifics of their sense of the way reality works. So, there are the elect. That is, these are the people that God has chosen to save and bring to heaven one day and so forth, through the sacrifice of Jesus and so on and so forth. And everybody else is pretty much screwed, because if God knows everything, then he has to know whether you're saved already or not, okay? And the way that you can demonstrate to yourself, say John Calvin and the Puritans and so forth, is through a process of sanctification, which means sort of a process of successive increases in your holiness. And holiness has already been defined as a function of basically work, right? So leisure is seen as kind of the diametric opposite. It's a lure to sin. It's a lure to spending time with women that you shouldn't be spending time with when, you know, maybe you should be out in the field working. That sort of thing. Okay? So, you can imagine things getting a little bit tense. And indeed, a whole bunch of wars in the 1500s and the 1600s and the 1700s start kind of playing out along tensions created along that divide. Okay? So, let's fast forward now to the 1600s, okay? And the Puritans are a particular form of Protestant. That's sort of extra hard line, right? We get quotes like, God sent you not into this world as a playhouse, but a workhouse, okay? So philosopher and historian Weber says, work was seen as holy, therefore leisure must not be. And we get this switch from the cyclical time that we talked about in the ancient history era to linear time, time as progress, not a cycle. So if we go from A to B to C in terms of years, we better have some new stuff to show for it in the meantime, not just kind of keeping ground, doing the same as we were doing last year, right? We got to make progress. Otherwise, we've wasted our time and we must not be among the elect, and therefore that's a real sort of theological problem, okay? So we have, with the Greeks, the idea of moderation. Work hard, but play hard. Right? In medieval Europe, we have sort of the idea of Carnival and Saturnalia, and then Lent to sort of repent of those things, and sort of wash our hands and move forward. And then in the Protestant and Puritan era of Western Europe, where non-Catholic churches are basically holding sway, we have the idea of austerity, which is a voluntary choice towards having less stuff. Working harder, making more money, but donating more money to the church, right? And improving things instead of cycling back to how things were at this time last year. We want to be farther ahead than we were last year, okay? That's a huge, huge shift. So this idea of progress is one that still sticks with us today, okay? So we still see in the 1600s the same idea that exercise is good for preparation to be in the military. So get fit so you can march off to serve in your landowners or your lord's mustered army to go serve the king, that sort of thing, right? Play is seen as a thing for children, and so things like troubadours and minstrels and court jesters are not well regarded in terms of any kind of prestige, even though they might be very skilled musicians. Now, was seen as a leisure time activity, and so therefore not a particularly respectable profession, right? So if play is for children, we have the unthinkable idea that things like soccer get banned. And indeed, in 1555, in Oxford, football, or soccer to them, football to them, soccer to us, was banned. It was seen as the glorification of violence and a dangerous temptation to sin because you could have pride in your athletic ability, right? So leisure is really seriously a negative thing. It's kind of weird. All right? The Puritans in particular, but the Protestants more generally, roll back a lot of the progress, so to speak, that the Catholics made in terms of designating special holidays or holy days, right? The focus shifts towards quiet family Sundays together with you, your wife, and your 15 kids that have survived and so forth, and sort of, you know, spending quality time with each other instead of, you know, running around kicking soccer balls or playing around in the woods or anything like that. It's sort of, let's, you know, contemplate scripture and stuff like that, okay? So a lot of these wars have been churning through. A lot of the young, healthy, vigorous males in particular during this time are tied up in sort of one war after another. But in 1648, the Peace of Westphalia allows a little bit of a lessening of military tension and aggression. So we now have a little bit of extra space, potentially at a broad social level across Europe, to engage in things like leisure and find ways for leisure to be okay and acceptable. Okay? Now, in the second half of the 1600s, we have quite the diaspora happening, right? So in 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue and so forth. And up to this point, individual voyages and expeditions have been finding or been trying to find passages across or around Africa, passages to what they thought was India in terms of the New World, right? Trying to find ways basically to trade with a well-established and vigorous Chinese and Southeastern Asia set of market cultures, okay? By the 1600s, in particular the mid-1600s, it's gotten to a point where it's not just individual ships going out. Trade routes are established, navigation practices are set up, shipping technology has advanced to the point where we're sending boatloads of people to some of these places, right? So this is now the era of exploding colonies all across the world. So Dutch East India Company, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the English, the French, right? There's a reason why these decidedly European languages are spoken all across the Caribbean, all across the Pacific Rim, all across the various countries of Africa and South America. The dominant languages are Spanish and Portuguese, right? Dominant languages North America, English and Spanish. So this is sort of when all of that is taking shape. So massive exodus of folks looking for economic opportunities, tired of being serfs, okay? Folks also looking for any kind of religious opportunity, in particular religious freedom. So the more radical among the Puritans head out from places like Holland, head out from places like England, because they were so hardcore, so hardline that they were having trouble even fitting in with sort of more mainline Protestants who had had some trouble fitting in with the Catholics, right? So this conflict ends up sort of pushing a lot of these people towards the New World to seek their own fortune and so forth. And that's pretty excellent, because it frees up access to, unfortunately for the First Peoples, First Nations, and Native Americans, access for Europeans to a whole lot of the material and resource-based wealth of what will later become the United States and the other colonies, right? So that has some important, repercussions that we'll talk about in our next session. But to finish up this one, we have a sense at this time that the natural world is still not just a dangerous place in terms of we don't have things like helicopter evacs off of mountains. And if you cut your leg, it might turn gangrenous and die because we can't really clean it very well. We have those problems, but at the same time, we also have a very sort of religious or spiritual layer superimposed on the natural resources that people these days love to use for stuff like recreation. So we have a very healthy, maybe to an extent unhealthy, fear of the wild, okay? So We'll talk a little bit in our next section about how the legend of Sleepy Hollow is a prime reflection of the idea that, my goodness, if there's a devil that's opposite God and doesn't like us very much, he probably lives in the woods, right? The woods are wild and dangerous and dark, and therefore evil. So that really shapes perceptions of things like outdoor recreation, okay? But that pretty much wraps it up for the relevant motifs across Western Europe from about the year 1000 AD or CE to sort of the mid-1600s when the focus shifts, for our purposes, over to the New World. See you there.